The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest live from Boston edition. It's Wednesday, October 22nd, 2014. On today's show, Birdman is the new anti-blockbuster blockbuster starring Michael Keaton as an aging Hollywood actor in search of artistic and personal redemption. And then, is the new Esquire article declaring Penelope Cruz the sexiest woman alive the dumbest piece of journalism ever? Or just in the bottom 5%? And finally, the polymathic everyman Robert Pinsky. He is a poet, an essayist, a translator, and pedagogue. He is here to talk about massive online learning and his favorite poems. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
I want to add that we're at the beautiful Wilbur Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. I love there was some absolutely awesome classic rock just cranking before we came out here. It was so freaking inappropriate, man. All right, digging in. Birdman is the new movie from director Alejandro González Iñárritu, he of Amores Perros and 21 Grams. Did I butcher the name, or am I okay?
That works for me. Iñárritu. Okay. Iñárritu?
Good. Yeah, very good. It features Michael Keaton as a Hollywood actor who once starred as a superhero in a comic book franchise, but now, nearing the twilight of his career, money and fame hang around his neck like an iron collar. He wants, instead, as he says, respect and validation to prove himself and to the world that he's a real actor. To that end, he personally bankrolled a Broadway production of his own adaptation of Raymond Carver's short stories. The movie also stars Naomi Watts, Ed Norton, and Zach Galifianakis. Now, we should begin by acknowledging, right, Julia Turner, that many people in this room have not seen the movie. It opens in Boston on Friday. So we want to situate you without spoiling it. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think there are two things this audience should know about the movie. The first is that until really the very, very end of the film, it's shot in what is meant to look like a single take with no evidence of cuts. If you know the Hitchcock movie Rope, right, Dana? That was the same illusion was striven for there. And then the second thing about the movie that gives nothing away and may help you make your way through this discussion is that he jibes at himself for having abandoned the Birdman franchise when it would have made him only more rich and famous by imagining his Birdman alter ego in full costume superhero regalia is in the room, hectoring him and peanut gallering him. Anyway, why don't we watch a clip from the movie. Dana, do you want to set this one up? Do you want me to set it up? What do you want
to
do?
Yeah, I think all that needs to be known for this one is that Michael Keaton's character, who is Regan Thompson, a sort of Michael Keaton-like aging actor who once played a superhero, except that unlike Michael Keaton, he's extremely resentful and nostalgic and fixated on his past glory, is putting on a Broadway show based on a Raymond Carver story. And in this early scene, we see him panicking because his lead actor has just been injured by a falling stage light, right? Right, and so he's desperately searching for a new lead. So this is probably about 5 minutes, 10 minutes into the movie.
We don't have an actor. And if we cancel the first preview, the press is going to smell blood, and we can't afford to lose any more money at all.
Okay, what do you think I should do?
Well, we hired an understudy. Let's use the understudy.
No.
Regan, listen to me, please, for the love of God. Listen, our perfect dream actor is not going to knock on that door and go, "Hey, fellas, when do I start?" You know?
Can I talk to you for a second?
Yeah, what's up?
Did you find another actor?
No.
Okay, well, Mike's available.
He is? Mm-hmm. Mike who? I thought he was doing the thing.
He quit. Or got fired.
Mike who? Which is it, quit or fired?
Oh, the Mike, it's usually both.
Mike fucking who?
Shiner.
Yes!
Jake.
Oh my gosh, how do you know Mike Shiner?
We share a vagina.
You think he'd want to do it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know?
Because he told me he wanted to do it.
Jake, yes. Asked me if he sells tickets.
Fine. Does he sell tickets?
He sells a shitload of tickets. Okay. Now ask me if the theater critics love him.
The theater critics love him.
They want to spooge on him.
Hey,
Leslie.
Right on his face.
Everything for a reason, right?
You think he'd come in this evening?
I'll call him and find out.
I'll call his agent. Amazing, amazing.
Lights, please. Thank you. Okay, Dana. The movie has many unexpected dimensions to it, one of which is that it's a challenging movie that made you big coin. I glanced at your review, but I'm curious to know what you thought of it.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in Birdman. It's this strange combination of factors where it's formally dazzling. You can't really see it in that shot, but you will in a clip that we show later, and we can talk about it too, about this illusion of a single long take that the whole two-hour-long movie is made of. That is spectacularly conceived and executed and so beautifully done that really just sort of watching it happen is enough to get you through the movie, but it struck me as a little bit of sound and fury signifying maybe not so much. And this backstage drama that it narrates is a fairly familiar one, really, really well acted by everybody, especially Michael Keaton. But it sometimes does feel to me like something is such a constantly high emotional pitch that there's no modulation and there's kind of nowhere to go except just hanging on for dear life as it takes you through this sort of ride-like experience. I don't know if you two experienced it that way.
I mean, I love the juicy backstage procedural of it. It is a self-conscious tour de force, both in the way it's filmed and the way it's performed. Do we have to love tour de forces if sometimes they just exhaust us?
I walked out of the movie theater last night more exhilarated by this movie than I have been by anything I've seen in a long time. And I think it's funny that you used the word ride, Dana. So the cinematographer in the film, and the star of the film is definitely the cinematography. I mean, I don't know why there have been all these Michael Keaton profiles. Obviously, he's easier to profile than a cinematographer, but it's you'll be able to pronounce his
Emmanuel
name.
Emmanuel Chivo Lubezki, who's the Mexican cinematographer who worked with, well, he's worked most famously and just won an Oscar for Gravity with Alfonso
Right, well,
Cuarón.
That's why I was bringing him up. The cinematography is the star of the movie, and I think when we talked about Gravity on the show when it came out last year, we had the same point that it felt like a ride, like it felt like you were there to see what the camera could do on this big canvas, you know, that wasn't like a YouTube video or a talking head or you were sitting with your butt in the seat in the dark room to experience something that felt more kind of thrilling and unexpected and technically challenging than you would expect from like an average half hour sitcom or whatever you were going to binge watch on Netflix that night. And, you know, this is, in addition to being a really interesting movie to watch, I think, you know, it's I think one of the first ones to come out this fall that's part of the, you know, the knell of Oscar movies that will keep tolling all fall and keep you incredibly busy, Dana, watching more worthy movies than your eyes can possibly handle. But this is one of the first big, like, Oscar buzzy contenders to come out. And it did strike me that maybe we're in an age where the movies that are going to get the big conversations are going to be these bravura technical performances as opposed to thematically interesting. I mean, I kind of agree that it's a little bit empty in the middle, like, aging guy looks back in his life, has regret, you know, like, it doesn't have a lot new. I regret touching that microphone. It is not, you know, I'm not sure it breaks new ground there or is particularly interesting, but it's just so fun to watch, and then the camera work is so amazing. I mean, there's not a single person I would say don't see this movie. It didn't bother me that it was empty at its core, basically.
Many things that are empty at their core are wonderful and fetching, but to be that, they ought to have a certain salutary awareness of their own emptiness, and I would not say that that's what distinguishes this particular movie.
I was going to say, this movie is a little bit in love with its own technique
and
its own frenzied pace.
First of all, I like the movie very much, and I recommend it highly. I think the performances are amazing, but it's a movie as cinematically self-conscious as it is with the camera, it's driven by the actors in it and the performances by the actors, which are great, but it raised the question for me over and over again. Okay, so you've externalized this particular artistic struggle in a way that's somewhat unique and novel, which is, you know, typically you have someone who what's squatting on his conscience is his own success. He's not someone who didn't achieve fame and money. In fact, he's someone who got everything he thought he wanted and then discovered he didn't. I thought, you know, that that's very provocative. And the way it's externalized and dramatized in the movie with this alter ego really haunting him and following him around, it's such an odd... Conscience doesn't usually take the form of telling you you left money on the table, right? Like you didn't go back for more.
I don't think the Birdman is his conscience. I was going to ask you what you guys think about all the kind of magic realist elements, but most specifically of this existence of his alter ego who haunts him in his dressing room and so forth. At times he seems to be kind of a conscience. Sometimes he seems to be a devil on the shoulder, tempting him back into some sort of life of egoism and self-absorption. It's really unclear to me what the moral that character is.
What I thought was interesting about it, Julie, correct me if I'm wrong, is that he's thrown his entire lot, like financially and aesthetically, into trying to make this Raymond Carver short story adaptation work. But the thing that's on him is this old, you know, superhero alter ego who's basically telling him, you fucking fool, like you left all this money, you didn't do this. I thought it was really the bizarre anti-conscience of success or something. Am I completely wrong?
No, I guess you're right, because it's not... The demon on his shoulder isn't saying you're going to fail. The demon on his shoulder is saying this effort is beneath you. Like, you don't have to be here in this dingy dressing room trying to make this play work with these weirdo Broadway people. But somehow, and you're right, that is more unexpected than I'd given it credit for. But it still doesn't seem to amount to a fascinating portrait of fame. I mean, to me, I think the movie works best if you kind of ignore all the magical realist elements and the, like, where's this guy in his life, and you just think of it as a really dark, really beautiful, like, backstage comedy, and then it's kind of great.
Mm-hmm. Dana, here's another way that I thought about it. Let me try this one. I did think of it as self-consciously an anti-blockbuster. It invokes a lot of images from the comic book franchise blockbusters as a way of, you know, deriding them, really, and looking down on them. He feels as though having played this character alienates him from his own humanity and his own potential to express it as an artist. I felt, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in order to earn the credibility with a wider audience for hating on something that the wider audience might like, it first had to vilify and sacrifice the critic. You must have noticed that this movie hates the figure of the critic.
Right. There's this figure of a theater critic who periodically will see her in a bar scribbling notes for her latest nasty, dismissing review. And then one of her climactic scenes with the Michael Keaton character is that he comes in on the night before their big opening preview. And she essentially tells him, I haven't even seen your play, but I've already decided I'm going to destroy it because I don't like you. Yeah, I mean, that was part of this movie's very narrow kind of cultural vision, that it's sort of... It imagines this world where an artist struggles to make his great work, right? I think that Iñárritu is very identified with that, and that in some ways it's about being a director, right? Not a film director in this case, but it's kind of him in living that fantasy. And forces, whether it's the force of, you know, the devil on his shoulder of the old Birdman, or the commerce, you know, Zach Galifianakis saying we don't have the money to put on the play, or this critic, that there's all these external forces that are keeping poor little Birdman from being able to put on his play. And I think that there is a little bit of a self-pitying strain running through it. And there's something very interesting to be said about the relationship between artists and critics, but I don't think that scene says it. It's just there's something about it that's just too sour and too narrow and too binary.
She's very much a cartoon figure. We're meant to, absolutely revile her. This gives nothing away, but he leans over her in a Broadway bar and he says, what must have happened to someone in their life that they become a critic? Which I ask myself every day.
Well, you can imagine that the laugh that got in the all-press screening that I saw the movie, and they loved it. They ate it up.
All right, I'm going to...
It's like Ratatouille, right? Nobody, critics love to be put down by fictional representations of themselves.
All right, I totally effed up, and I forgot we had a second clip. I throw it open, a vote to the group. Do we go look at the second clip?
I think we should show the second clip, because it gives a sense of that vertiginous motion of the camera.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, Dana, too, what you make of this kind of stunt filmmaking. It's obviously beautiful, but, like, is it a little bit too much? Just to set this up, it'll start out on stage. They found the actor they were talking about in the first clip. He's played by Edward Norton. He comes on stage, and they're kind of testing out the lines. And you'll see it's a little bit of a power struggle between him and Michael Keaton's character. And then from there, the camera just takes us.
Hey, I'm the wrong person to ask.
That's the thing. See, I'm the wrong person to ask. What is it? I think it's fuck you. Fuck you. Don't put me on the spot, man. Don't make me feel self-conscious about my marriage while my wife is sitting...
Right there.
Right there?
Yeah.
Can I sit there?
Yeah, sit. Okay. Sit. Good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. So just give it to me as a fuck you. Right. Try it. Lay it on me. Yeah. Let's just do it. Come on, give it to
well,
me.
I'm thinking,
fuck me hard.
Okay.
Give it. Right. Come on, don't talk about it. Just
I'm the wrong person to ask, right? I don't even know the guy, okay? What's your point?
What's my point?
Yeah, what's your point? What are you saying? Spit it out.
Oh.
You're saying what?
Oh.
What are you saying? You're saying love is absolute.
Yes. Yes. The kind of love that I'm talking about, it is absolute. The kind of love that I'm talking about, you don't try to kill people.
The Edward Norton character is really just so funny.
He's pretty hilarious. By the way, that was like me and Pinsky in the green room before we came out here. fuck me. No, you fuck me.
Something I just thought of seeing them together, too, that I didn't think of seeing it before, is that Ed Norton and Michael Keaton have very similar energies as actors in a way. They're both a little bit hammy, very intense, a little bit... They have that kind of intellect, you know? They have an intellectual edge to what they're playing, even when they're playing a little bit of a meathead.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way before, but it's Ed Norton... The role that he plays is meant to send Michael Keaton's character further in the direction of your sympathies, because it's Norton who's the crazy actor who just takes method beyond method to someplace completely self-indulgent and insane and then needs to bring it back, so that as Keaton is digging these deep, maundering monologues about acting, you think, oh, he's not the heavy. You know, it's meant to kind of build sympathy with him.
This segment's going to go too long, but I have to ask you guys, did you think that the production of the Raymond Carver story that Michael Keaton's character was putting on was supposed to be a good play or not? That seems important to the sense of the movie for me. There's moments of triumph. There's moments of, you know, when it lands terribly in front of the audience. But I couldn't tell overall whether Iñárritu wanted us to think that it was a good show.
I think that scene is actually kind of key to it, because you do earlier in the movie you see a much worse version of that scene, and you do feel the charge that they feel, like connecting with each other on the stage. You feel like they've gotten something that they hadn't had before. It seems like a hammy, overwrought night at the theater. Like, it doesn't actually seem necessarily great. The movie doesn't seem to care whether the play is good, and maybe that's a flaw of the movie.
I agree. Yeah.
But maybe it doesn't matter. I don't know. I mean, I just, before we close, I know we've gone too long, but I mean, that the filmmaking stunt of it, the bravura of it, it was mesmerizing. It wasn't irritating, even though I think of myself as someone who's irritated by high concept stunts like that. And I'm just curious, Dana, what you thought.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it sounds like it swept you up more than it swept me up. I think I was very early on able to make this division between the form and the content and say, okay, content-wise, this is not going to be anything that'll blow me away, but it's so formally interesting that I'll go with it. But I think that does make it a little bit of a gimmick and a stunt, because it doesn't feel like it's unfolding naturally from the essence of the material.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little bit like something laid on top, like, you want to do some long shots in Gravity, Alfonso Cuarón? I'll go you one better. You know, there's a little bit of a sense of, like, I'm going to show you what I can do. And to me, it makes Iñárritu seem like a less fascinating filmmaker than Cuarón.
Mm. All right, well, the movie is Birdman. It opens widely, I think, this Friday. Go check it out. Tell us what you think of it at our Facebook page, facebook.com/CultureFest. All right, we're backstage at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, Massachusetts, and this podcast is brought to you by Acura and the all-new 2015 TLX luxury performance sedan. For decades, Acura has built performance sedans with unwavering purpose and passion. The all-new 2015 TLX represents more than the latest evolution. It's the clearest expression yet of Acura's performance philosophy. It's power and control brought into perfect balance. It's anticipating where the driver wants to go, changing the way the wheels move and guide you. It's uncompromised design in the name of unrestrained feeling, putting exhilaration front and center once again. It's that kind of thrill. Check out the all-new 2015 TLX at Acura.com/TLX. Or better yet, experience the thrill for yourself. Go and take a test drive at your local Acura dealer. All right, well, back to the show. Julia, correct me if I'm wrong, but stipulated, people love lists, superlatives, and digitally enhanced side boob. Nonetheless, you can answer that if you'd like.
At Slate, we only traffic in a few of those, but I won't say which one.
So maybe now isn't the time to announce Slate's sexiest adjunct alive issue.
Not yet. I can't reveal.
We'll leave that be. Okay. Nonetheless, can whatever affection anyone might still have for the sexiest fill-in-the-blank alive genre really survive this latest installment? From Esquire, about the actress Penelope Cruz, their piece naming her the sexiest woman alive begins with a several-hundred-word rhapsody about bullfighting in Madrid. It reads a little like Hemingway if Hemingway had been beaten senseless with an old J. Peterman catalog before sitting down at the typewriter, and it goes on and on. I am not exaggerating. I mean, it's preposterous. You feel as though maybe you were snuck a tab of acid before you started reading. It's unreal. And then there's finally a break, an actual physical break in the text, and then you read, Penelope Cruz lifts her perfect eyebrows from her bottomless brown eyes at the mention of Sunday's entertainment. The bullfights, she says. The bullfights? Because there was an echo. She says again, as though she has never heard the word. Her mouth turns down at its corners. Julia. Every now and then the gob is smacked as if for the first time. And I mean, this is, I'm at such a loss for word, I'm going to totally plagiarize you. You said the way to frame this is the state of ogling in the age of internet porn and internet feminism. Go.
Well, I really feel for the editors of Esquire. I mean, this... This thing that they do, The Sexiest Woman Alive, it's a thing that a lot of magazines do a version of, right? People has The Sexiest Man Alive. Sports Illustrated has the swimsuit issue. Very early in my career, I worked at Sports Illustrated Women, where we had a men's swimsuit issue. And for that, I came up to Boston and got to watch Adam Vinatieri in a bathing suit, super greased up, like kicking a football into a white seamless all afternoon. Very close. Can't say that that was the journalistic highlight of my career, but it was definitely interesting. So magazines do this. It's a way to gather, attract attention. You can get a famous person to show up for something if you're giving them an award as opposed to if you're just writing about them. And, you know, so these things, these pieces still happen. But the likelihood that any of them would be good and not make you embarrassed for the magazine that's doing them, as particularly in Esquire's case, is diminished because there are a bunch of forces working against it. One is celebrities have no need to give access to journalists anymore. They don't need journalists to interpret them or sell them in quite the way that they used to. If they want to showcase their own, you know, cool, funny, off-the-cuffness, they can start a Twitter account or an Instagram feed or a Tumblr and convey whatever, you know, little anecdotes of personal life they want to share in their own controlled way. You know, Beyonce does this with her Instagram right now. You know, she's been accused of photoshopping her own Instagrams to suggest that she has like an even skinnier golf course self than you thought, you know, whatever, but they can massage their own personal presentation and get out that kind of, oh, she's such a nice girl anecdotes that used to be the province of this sort of piece, that used to be what was in it for a celebrity to do a piece like this. So the journalists get no access. I mean, this whole piece is an elaborate write-around that substitutes bullfighting for the fact that the guy got 20 minutes at lunch with Penelope Cruz. She's, you know, there's a lot of references in the profile to she just had kids. Her husband, Javier Bardem, is away. She doesn't want to answer any questions. She eats a steak and walks out of the restaurant, leaving me behind like a stuck bull.
But she leaves a puddle of blood and a bone on the plate, Julia. And I reminiscent of a bullfight, if you will.
I won't. But, you know, I feel like there's contempt for the whole project laced through the piece in a way that you can just read it and it makes you feel bad for the people writing it and editing it. That said, Esquire has its own particular pompous and weird way of doing leering that has always rubbed me the wrong way. Like, if you're Maxim, or I mean, Playboy, I don't even know, but if you're Maxim, you're like, we're going to grease him up and put him in a, like, Santa bodice and stick him on the cover for December.
And have him kick field goals.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, man, she's hot. It's the hot list. Esquire likes to pretend they're, like, the literary man's ogle. And so, like, the piece will always be... They'll take care to really emphasize some unusual body part, like her lovely ankles or her her like sinuous limbs or her gorgeous clavicle. Like, they can't just admit that they're looking at the parts that everybody else looks at. And I honestly can't think who is the audience for this kind of piece. I mean, apart from like journalists who want to titter about it. But like, Steve, you are a very literary man.
Oh, God.
Like, does it make you feel better to ogle half-naked pictures of hot actresses if there's like purple prose around it?
Have I told you I play guitar? I'm a guitarist. Let me put it this way. Okay, I find Penelope Cruz is a very beautiful woman, incredibly talented actress. I mean, I can't even I can't even bullshit it. I mean, I just thought those photographs were so demeaning to her talents and her essence. I just, the photographs that accompany the profile are really just, Dana, they strike me as just, I hate to be the, you know, I hate to get up on the Julia Turner park bench, but that is like, that is some inappropriate shit. Yes?
You didn't like the yellow, what was Swiss dot? They have her in all kinds of get-ups.
Let me move on, Julia. I have a little game I'd like to play, okay? And also we're going to start with a total softball. All right, I'm going to read the quote from a sexiest ex alive profile, and you tell me who the star is. You can shout it out, too. The first one's so easy, okay? In the course of the evening, she will allow me to moisten the tip of my finger with my tongue and try to...
Listeners, we have to explain that got just like an audible ugh from the audience.
I wrote this, by the way. it was my Alan Smithy project. And try to wipe off the makeup under which had once been written Billy Bob.
Right, so that's a gimme.
Oh, yeah, I started with a gimme.
Right. Angelina Jolie.
Very good. Okay, here's the next one. She grabs her own radiant ass. It's a portrait of, it's a profile of Dana Stevens, actually, in Salon. Oh my God. All right. She grabs her own radiant ass. She handles it, offers it, like it's a rump roast.
About that one, which I happen to know is Rihanna because it was quoted in a great Slate piece about this whole phenomenon, is like, what restaurant is that writer eating? Like, when are you served rump roast in that manner? Like, a slice carved off of it in a plate of oat juice? Like, it's not... Anyway, so many
radiantly
meat metaphors.
Grabbed by the waitress.
Steve, you are totally obfuscating and deflecting and avoiding my question.
I've got one more. Just give me one more. And then I'll sing one by you two with the guitar. You people, you are so
well. Wait, but that actually raises that raises one question, though. I mean, the thing that has happened now, I really do think that these pieces are at this funny juncture between internet porn and internet feminism. Like, whatever person, you know, this style of writing about women that Esquire, you know, has perfected, or whatever you will say, of sort of the thinking man's ogle, just seems less and less and less useful than it ever was in an era where you can immediately click up pictures of whoever you want and whatever state of undress you want at any time. And also this moment where there is this rising culture of feminism on the web where every single thing that gets written in this vein is going to get scrutinized by a bunch of really smart writers at a bunch of really smart sites. I mean, one of my favorite things that Slate published last week was Katie Waldman's assessment of, is it possible to write a halfway decent profile like this? And as Steve's example suggests, it is very difficult. I think she did conclude that a guy did a kind of nice job with Mila Kunis a couple years ago.
Did you say Mila Kunis?
Mila Kunis.
Mila Kunis.
She was in Black Swan. She was the bad girl.
Yeah.
In any event, you know, like, it just, it's easy to make fun of it, but it also just feels like it's this culture of looky-loo at celebrities that is dying.
But is People's Sexiest Man Alive, should it be subject to the same scrutiny? Or because the genders are reversed, is it somehow less ogly and leering? I mean, to me, People's Sexiest Man Alive seems like sort of the classier manifestation of this same scenario, right?
Well, I mean, I think this comes... Whenever you're ogling men, there's like a frisson of newness to it because they're less obviously ogled. Maybe once they get more used to being ogled and more beleaguered by oglement, they will... we will resist that too, but it feels... It sort of feels like such a lark, The Sexiest Man Alive. Like, it doesn't actually impinge. And also, they don't... I mean, for all that, I was there in the room when they greased up Adam Vinatieri and made him kick for, like, 2 hours. Fundamentally, he was there because he had achieved something on the football field. Whereas it feels like they're like, we need someone hot who'll say yes this year.
Right. This calls to mind an incredible story, right? So, first of all, I think there are two related but somewhat separable issues. There's one, how the use of these images sells magazines And I think we can watch as both this kind of feature and the magazine as we've known it swirl down the toilet together, right? I mean, that well, Slate's not the magazine as we ever knew it, right? And then there's how these images are used to sell the star image of the actress, right? And there's this incredible story from the early 80s about Michael Eisner or Simpson and Bruckheimer, the producers, were casting Flashdance, and it came down to three actresses, one of whom was Demi Moore, one of whom was the woman who got the part whose name is Jennifer Beals, and a third who's lost to history. And they couldn't pick. It was like an eeny meeny situation. They didn't know what to do. So Michael Eisner, there were some Teamsters, some union guys doing work in the hallway. He's like, guys, come in here. And he puts down three, like, you know, sexy shots of all three actresses. And he says, which one do you want to fuck? And like all of them were like Jennifer Beals. And they were like, you get the part. And that's the origin of a word that is still current in Hollywood to describe actresses, which is fuckable, right? And it's...
I have a feeling that's not the origin of that word.
As,
we'll consult the OED
as,
on that one.
oh my God. You should do a Dikembe Mutombo finger wag when you do those. No, but as a term of art in Hollywood, I do think that that's the origin of it. It was not widely in circulation before that. But anyway, this is what leads... I mean, Penelope Cruz is part of this equation, too. It's not just some, you know, dimwit, overwrought, you know, oxygen-deprived writer flushing his prose with purple. You know, it's and an editor who's willing to abide by it, and a magazine that's willing to stick around the cover and demeanor in this way. She's part of the equation too. She agrees to it for a reason, and that's a horrible reason. It has nothing at all to do with her being shallow. It has to do with the economy and the sexual economy of her own business and image. And it's sad that she has to do it.
I have to say though that she comes off really well in that profile because she's completely opaque. I mean, the person who sits there for two paragraphs in the middle of this huge, enormous blather about bullfighting and eats a steak and leaves seems so much classier and more dignified than anyone else on the page or writing it.
It's true. You do come away with respect for her contempt for the whole project. But then
then you see the photos.
But then that makes the whole thing feel like very curdled and transactional, where you're like, all right, well, she agreed to like pull her camisole down and like pout at the camera and eat a steak and get out of town.
And it's a bad date. It's like a really bad date.
Exactly.
All right. So one last one. Any guesses? Who she looks like a woman. She exudes womanness. Is.
Madeleine Albright? Scarlett Johansson.
It is, yeah. All right, well, I think we've done this subject justice. Moving on. I don't want to say the words, speaking of fuckable.
Just
we please edit that out of my head? Can you be the fucking eternal spot sunshine me right now? I can't believe I made that joke about the wonderful polymath Robert Pinsky, but I had to. He and I had quite the get a room moment backstage. Like, Julia actually had to leave
the
room.
They were literally like reciting Frost
in unison,
like at each other.
The shattered water made a misty.
Enough.
Yeah, okay. Robert Pinsky is a poet, translator, essayist, editor, and pedagogue. I love that word. He's professor of English and creative writing at Boston University. He was the Poet Laureate of the United States, and for Slate, he has written about everything from the virtues of memorizing poetry, even if badly, to the myth of John Keats having been killed by a bad review. Will you please welcome the wonderful Robert Pinsky to the stage? Thank you so much for indulging this.
Great pleasure so far.
All right, before we really dig in for reals, it's a great American poet's birthday today.
Ah.
Who is that?
It's not Arthur Rimbaud, and it's not Mickey Mantle, though it is both of their birthdays today, and it is also mine.
Boom.
Those are much fancier birthday shares than I have. The most famous person who has my birthday is Britney Spears.
I'm Virginia Woolf and Robert Burns. Dana, you surely...
I'm Princess Diana. I can't remember who else.
I got to get some better names.
All right, well, clearly we'd like to talk to you about everything, but we don't have time for that. So we thought we'd concentrate on two subjects in particular, the MOOC, which stands for Massive Open Online Courses. We'll get to the second one in a minute. These are free online college courses often taught by eminences, such as yourself. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 million people have signed up for MOOCs. How many are signed up for your teaching one called The Art of Poetry? How many do you got so far?
15,000 people registered for The Art of Poetry. It's now in its third week. And of the 15,000 who registered by clicking, it's free as well as open and massive. Some 6,000 are watching the video lectures and discussions and doing this stuff. So I'm told that's a very good, what do you call a non-attrition rate? The retention, thank you. We have retained 6,000 so far out of 15,000.
That's magnificent. And in the course teaser, you say this course is based on the conviction that the more you know about an art, the more pleasure you will find in it. I wanted to ask you, when I was a graduate student in English literature, pleasure was a little bit like crying in baseball in Eight Men Out or whatever the Tom Hanks movie is. Is that it? No, it's the other one. League of Their Own, exactly. Anyway, when I had pro, you know, there was no pleasure in poetry. Is one appeal of teaching a class outside of the traditional confines of academia that you get to talk about pleasure in poetry without hesitation or shame?
I've been talking about pleasure in poetry in classrooms and all the time. I had a very, very disgraceful high school career. I did not get good grades. I have all my life only liked to do things I feel like doing. There was a time in my life when it got me a lot of trouble. For the last 25 or 30 years, it seems okay. I don't read things that I think are boring. I don't eat food I don't want. I just do what I feel like it. And that's my approach to trying to help people enjoy poetry. I almost wonder if course is the wrong word for the MOOC. It is set up as a course. There are sort of chapters a week. So far, it's more like making a book or a movie. There are these 10-minute mini lectures that I give, and then we have people around a table, eight people, and it's a high school kid. It's a gardener, professional landscaper. It's not necessarily poets or students. And we talk, or I give the lectures, and we filmed it in a black box. So it's not a filmed classroom. And I now in week three, on the discussion forum, people say, is it too late to start? And of course, we say, no, it's the web. This stuff is all there. And that is why I think that in a way the word course, it's a convenient way to sort of convey what it is. But it's starting to feel more like something I wrote or some mixed media thing I did. It is indeed devoted to pleasure, which I do associate with the word art. It's called The Art of Poetry.
Well, it seems to me among the many mandates you've exhibited in your career so far is you want to disinhibit people a little bit when it comes to poetry. I too got crap grades in school for the longest time. I associated poetry with homework, with a archaic formalism, with learning something I didn't care to learn. And it was over time I realized it is maybe the deepest pleasure there is, possibly. That is that part of what you invest in the MOOC, but also the Favorite Poem Project?
Yeah. I feel like Julia's saying she feels sorry for the editors at Esquire. I feel sorry for school. We need school. School is a good thing, basically. And it makes so many things go wrong. Sports. There are people who, because of some humiliation in school, don't enjoy sports. Dancing. People would say, "Oh, I don't know how to dance." A three-year-old at a wedding starts dancing. The music plays and the kid moves around. And as is said about drawing and painting, little children enjoy poetry. And they don't feel, oh, I'm not smart enough for it or I need to be instructed in it. And if you put a kid in your lap and you read Edward Lear or Dr. Seuss or Robert Louis Stevenson, they have a good time. And it's intellectually demanding. So can a lot of things be. And it's also physically demanding. You have to be willing. It's, for me, the moment of poetry is like the moment when you're thinking something and you're about to say it. I have an idea, and then I'm going to say, I have an idea, or something. And when you say the poem by Emily Dickinson, or William Butler Yeats, or Robert Hayden, you're sharing that moment when you need to say a certain thing. It's intellectual, and it's bodily. And that's the whole idea of the MOOC, is that it is... You're supposed to feel it in two places. And it is like when you're... That moment of speech is at that mind-body transition. That's so deep in us. You know, I have an idea, and then I start making these little grunts come out of my special organ I have here. And this breath. And that's right where the mind and the body come together, is every time you start to yak.
It's funny to focus on the mind-body connection in a form that's so virtual and so digital. Do you have a sense of how students are responding, how the people watching the course are responding to it, what their take is, what they're learning?
I have often had to deal with this thing of page or the stage, and I'm not either one. It's not theatrical, it's not written. And the web offers an actual auditory experience. In fact, you can see somebody's face when they read a poem. And it was making the favorite poem videos made me realize you can see someone read a poem. It's not just like when I watch your face when you're listening to music, or I watch your face while you're reading a novel. When I see you say a poem aloud, I was watching Stephen say To Earthward in the green room, you are watching that person read a poem. And I think the web medium, the digital medium, is very good for that. And in a way, it restores a kind of sociable way that people do poetry in many cultures, and including my personal one. So in a way, the web gives Americans an opportunity to become just a little bit more like Arabs or Bengalis reciting to one another.
Robert, you talked about the MOOC, but you didn't say much about the Favorite Poems Project. And I wanted you to talk about that and how it started and how you find people to do it.
The advertising budget for the Favorite Poem Project back in around 2000 was something like $11. And any time I was interviewed, I was poet laureate at the time, I would say, will you print our little form in your magazine or newspaper? I'd say it in audio. And we got 18,000 people, and it was not a poll. I said, write a few sentences about why you love a particular poem. And it gives a whole other idea of what Americans are like. 18,000 people wrote sentences. And if you go to favoritepoem.org, you'll see a construction worker talking very cogently about Leaves of Grass, and he reads his passages from Leaves of Grass very well, not in a hammy way. You'll see a Cambodian-American high school student read Langston Hughes's Minstrel Man, and she'll relate that to the horrible, horrible experience of her family fleeing the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. And these are Americans who did write these sentences, and then we videoed them. I'm happy to say we have some new ones. We shot six in Chicago. We're going to do some new ones. So you can go on the web now at favoritepoem.org and see Tom Moran, a school custodian outside of Chicago. And he reads Theodore Retke's The Waking and talks about his job. And they seem almost made up. I've had people ask me, who were these actors? I didn't find the people. They found the project. And thank you, Dana, for asking about
They're really extraordinary videos. I really advise everyone to go look at the favorite poem site, because they are such unexpected stories and unexpected choices on the parts of many of the readers.
Yeah. Schools sometimes have favorite poem things. This one thing I love is that one school listed all of the favorite poems without saying who had chosen them, so you could guess which was the principal, which was the custodian, and so forth. I think they're a great teaching tool, and they're also, they're fun to watch. You get the combination of art, person reading a poem, and gossip. You know, why this Chinese-American kid in Atlanta chose that.
Right. Now that I know that you judge how people read them, I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit this, but we brought favorite poems for you.
That's great. In a word, cool.
Fuckable. All right, who wants to... You got to go cheap.
That wasn't the word I had.
Who wants to start?
Dana?
Well, we're flashing them up on the screen, right? And I think I'm first.
Okay, excellent.
Just to set up my poem, I brought in my own ancient, much bookmarked copy of Emily Dickinson's Complete Poetry, because mine is an Emily Dickinson poem untitled, like all of her poems. It's from 1862, which was the period when she was kind of writing at a white heat. It was when she wrote all her greatest poems in the early 1860s and late 1850s. And, of course, choosing your favorite poem is an absurdity by definition, but this is one that I love very much, and one of the few that I know by heart, but I probably won't be able to do it in front of you, so I'll read it out loud. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb, when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Themself are one, we brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met a night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. So I wanted to read this one because I think it's an incredible poem, but it's something that's a simple idea that I can sort of talk about in front of everybody. I think what speaks to me so much in this poem has to do with how it's about the limits of poetry, right? I mean, it takes Keats's beauty is truth, truth, beauty, and finds a third term, right? Finds something outside of it, which is that whatever ideal you die for, right, you're still there. You're still just a body in a tomb sort of moldering away, and yet it's strangely not a depressing poem. I find it a really inspiring and uplifting one. Something about this conversation between the two dead people about their different values when they were alive. It's a ghostly conversation. It's such a great idea for a poem.
Yeah,
and then just the rhyme scheme and the delicacy. It's just, it says so much in those three stanzas.
Yeah, something as grim in a way as the moss had reached our lips, because it's so eloquent and it's just so good, it cheers you up. It makes you, until the moss had reached our lips. Yeah.
It also feels though like that's like their conversation is drawing to a close at the end. Like when the moss gets there, maybe they'll stop, but at least they've found some kind of commonality.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I guess I have no excuse for why that poem doesn't depress me, but yeah, I agree with you, Robert.
It's something about art. Frankly, I don't see what's so great about having the text up on the screen.
Well, I'm so interested in this because I'm such a visual person. So I love your favorite poems videos, but I'm like dying to see the text in front of me. Amazing.
You got your wish.
Wow. I have so much power in this new job.
I think Andy's checking his email.
All right, well, mine is an excerpt from poem 52 from Midsummer, which is a poem cycle by Derek Walcott, and I think published in 1984. No language is neutral. The green oak of English is a murmurous cathedral where some took umbrage, some peace, but every shade, all, helped widen its shadow. I used to haunt the arches of the British barracks of Vigy. There were leaves there, bright, rotting like revers or epaulets, and the stenches of history and piss. Leaves piled like the dropped H's of soldiers from rival shires, from the brimstone trenches of Agincourt to the gas of the Somme. On Poppy Day, our schools bought red paper flowers. They were for Flanders. I saw Hotspur cursing the smoke through which a popinjay minced from the battle. Those raging commanders from Thersites to Percy, their rant is our model. I pinned the poppy to my blazer. It bled like a vowel. I love this poem because I grew up in the city completely enamored of the English language, and not yet fully cognizant of all of the history behind it, right? I mean, I don't think anyone could be cognizant of all of the history behind it, but it's this incredibly beautiful, potent, interesting, complicated language that has so many influences within it, that has done so much, that was an agent of this empire, that did so many dark things all over the planet. And I love how this poem plays with the language, you know, takes it, tells some of that story, and does it with this rollicking rhythm that you just can't let go of. And then I just love that last line. Like, I feel like the way he lands that plane, you're just like, damn.
Yes. And it's a little bit like the moss, you know, it bled like a vowel about the red poppy. Just...
And correct me if I'm wrong, this is Derek Walcott's probably partially his relationship to the English language, right?
Yes, it's colonial... interesting. Both poems are in part about a relationship to language that's not just totally ardent and committed.
Right.
That's partly a relationship to language that is, it's like a troubled love affair, in this case with the English language itself.
Yeah. But it's like anyone who's capable of conjuring those rhythms and all of those slant rhymes is someone who's totally in love with the language, even as he's writing about how complicated
It
is.
Derek, if I can quote Derek, someone of my colleague and friend, Derek has said, colonialism made me read Shakespeare. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I was once on a panel. Somebody set up a panel on empires, and there were three of us. There's, I think, great Polish poet Adam Zagajewski talking about the Soviet Empire, Derek talking about the British Empire. I had the unpleasant task of talking about the American Empire.
Really, which prevented you from reading Shakespeare.
Perhaps. And Derek fooled everybody and confused the audience completely by speaking in praise of the British Empire. And he contrasted it with the French. French people I know have been infuriated when I tell them this. But he says that the teachers and the gendarmes in the English-speaking islands were native people. And he has a lot of, clearly in this poem, you know, the stench of piss in history. But he's very aware that the reason English has such a fat dictionary, bigger than the English, than the French or the Italian dictionary, is the island was invaded so many times that the Germanic tribes expropriated and raped and dominated the Celts, and the Scandinavians came in, and all these waves, and then the Norman invasion. And the vocabulary from all this horrible history, the language itself became kind of omnivorous and polyglot because it, you know, it became an imperial language, but it was also a kind of a pigeon after pigeon after pigeon, or Creole after Creole, because of all those invasions.
Hmm. All right. Well, in contrast, my poem is from Robert Frost, who was a classicist and very well read in Greek and Latin. And I've always believed that the great towering achievement of Robert Frost is taking vernacular American English and turning it into an ancient language. And this poem is called To Earthward. And should I do the whole thing? It's not that short.
Oh, do the whole thing.
To Earthward by Robert Frost. Love at the lips was touch as sweet as I could bear. And once that seemed too much, I lived on air that crossed me from sweet things. The flow of, was it musk from hidden grapevine springs downhill at dusk? I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle. I craved strong sweets, but those seemed strong when I was young. The petal of the rose it was that stung. Now no joy but lacks salt that is not dashed with pain and weariness and fault. I crave the stain of tears, the aftermark of almost too much love, the sweet of bitter bark and burning clove. When stiff and sore and scarred, I take away my hand from leaning on it hard in grass and sand. The hurt is not enough. I long for weight and strength to feel the earth as rough to all my length. I've just always, Robert, regarded this as a perfect poem. I just can't imagine it any other way than the way it is. Each word is perfectly placed. You said something great in the green room that I'd never really noticed before, which is the flow of the poem itself in the earliest stanzas flows over and beyond the rhymes as if he is moving quickly and flowing downhill at dusk. And then he gets to the turn in the poem.
When stiff and sore and scarred.
And those are beats. Those are downbeats. Yeah. And all of a sudden you realize, yeah, you know, the heavy...
I love the moment in the poem when he makes fun of himself a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's thinking about his youthful aestheticism and how he's almost too sensitive to live. He says, I crave strong sweets, but those seemed strong when I was young. The petal of the rose it was that stung. And that grammatical inversion of not the petal of the rose it was that stung. And that has a little air of self-parody in it. That it's there's so much control there where he can make his voice sound just a little oversensitive.
Oh, absolutely. And it's an echo of I fall upon the thorns of life,
yes,
I bleed, right? It's
yes, this, and the petal stung me, so I'm more sensitive than
even
Shelley.
Shelley, yeah. What I love about the poem also is that to Earthward, I mean, it really is about the arc of a life heading towards the grave, to being interred permanently in Earth, and as a last attempt to produce intense feeling, one is willing to tolerate
feel
enormous amounts of
all my length.
Yeah, I mean, just the force with which he wants to feel something, and that allows him to wish for, you know, that degree of pain.
I had never read this poem before today, before you sent it along, Steve, and it's funny to read a Frost poem, and usually in a Frost poem you can feel its frostiness early on, and this one I was like, honeysuckle, grape vine, and then finally when you get to the salt, you're like, ah, all right, you get to those like hard, flat, earthy words.
Yeah, he's better known for his less good poems.
Yeah.
You know, the one with the two paths in the wood is not terrible, but it's not as good as this, or The Most of It, or Directive, or An Old Man's Winter Night. I mean, Frost, in a way, he's not known for his best poems. So this poem, I've recited this poem to an audience that's a pretty smart audience. Said, who do you think wrote it? And they have no idea.
Huh.
Though it's your, you know, the big national poet.
Amazing. All right, well, we have you here. We have to ask you. There's no answer to it. But in your current mood, tell us a favorite poem.
Well, my mood just changed because all of these poems were very, very great poems, beautiful poems, more or less in traditional meters. So I think it might be important to have a poem in free verse. So I'll do a very short poem by William Carlos Williams. William Carlos Williams, you know, was a medical doctor. He was said to have kept a typewriter in his office so he could do a quick poem between patients. And the poem just describes the roofers. And I think it's a good demonstration of how free verse, too, is intensely musical in the vowels and consonants. This poem starts off in the key of eh, and it modulates into ooh. Fine work with pitch and copper. Now they're resting in the fleckless light separately and in unison, like the sacks of sifted stone stacked regularly by twos about the flat roof, ready after lunch to be opened and strewn. The copper in 8-foot strips has been beaten lengthwise at right angles and lies ready to edge the coping. One still chewing picks up a copper strip and runs his eye along it. And it's such great noticing, aside from how beautiful the sound, and have the middle sentence of the three is, could be in a roofer's manual. The copper in 8-foot strips has been beaten lengthwise at right angles and lies ready to edge the coping. One still chewing picks up a copper strip and runs his eye along it. And Williams notices things like when you're eating and about to start work, you give yourself the luxury of doing both at once and sort of chewing and looking down that piece of copper. It's the alertness of his eye and what he notices that he records by making such great music out of free verse. He did say somewhere that when he was young, he more or less memorized the entire Palgrave's Treasury, which is this basically 19th century anthology of poetry. And he absorbed the Keats and Milton, and he made it into these other free verse American rhythms. So I was going to do a Yeats, but I decided we needed...
Man, which Yeats?
I was going to do
Adam's
Curse.
I was going to do Adam's Curse.
That's so great. We've grown as weary-hearted as...
I could say it, and then you could just cut it out of the podcast.
I don't think we have to hear it.
All right.
This is... when you have the man in the room, you want the full Pinsky.
As long as the full Pinsky sounds like it belongs to that other discussion. He did the full Pinsky. Adam's Curse. We sat together at one summer's end, that beautiful, mild woman, your good friend, and you and I, and talked of poetry. I said, a line may take us hours, maybe. Yet if it doesn't seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. Better get down upon your marrow bones and scrub a kitchen pavement or break stones like an old pauper in all kinds of weather. For to articulate sweet sounds together is to work harder than all of these and yet be thought an idler by the noisy set of bankers, schoolmasters, and clergymen, the martyrs call the world. And thereupon... that beautiful, mild woman for whose sake there's many a one shall find out all heartache on finding that her voice is sweet and low, said, to be born a woman is to know, although they do not talk of it at school, that we must labor to be beautiful. I said, it's certain there's no fine thing since Adam's fall but needs much laboring. There have been lovers who thought love should be so much compounded of high courtesy that they would sigh and quote with learned looks precedents out of beautiful old books. But now it seems an idle trade enough. We sat grown quiet at the name of love. We watched the last embers of twilight die, and in the trembling blue-green of the sky, a moon, so pale it seemed to be a shell washed by time's waters as they rose and fell about the stars and broke in days and years. I had a thought for no one's but your ears, that you were beautiful, and that I strove to love you in the old highway of love, that it had all seemed happy, and yet we'd grown as weary-hearted as that hollow moon.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Robert Pinsky. All right, well, if you haven't wearied of us, we have a little ritual at the end of our program. It's called endorsing. Would you stick around and endorse with us?
Sure. Sure.
That was a micro hesitation there. I was in my seat. Dana, what do you got?
Okay. That was so good. I love the shift to the direct address at the end of that poem.
Oh, and where he breaks your heart. It's all an account of a conversation.
Right.
And then he says what he's thinking is, this has all gone wrong.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah, it's a great, great shift. All right, so my endorsement. Bill Moyers is a national treasure. He is a beloved journalist. He's 80 years old now, and after multiple exits from TV and faux retirements, he's still doing a show on PBS. It's called Bill Moyers and Company. It's just half an hour long. And I've always said this about Bill Moyers. I think I talked about this when after Maurice Sendak died, and we did a segment on him and said that the best interview I'd seen with him, and really one of the best interviews with an artist that I'd ever seen, was by Bill Moyers. And so there's something about when he speaks to someone who's really a great artist, somebody who really sort of has that kind of stature and that kind of relationship to their work, that he can get amazing things out of them. And his last interview, or maybe second to last on his show, Bill Moyers and Company, was with Marilyn Robinson, the novelist who just came out with a new novel, Lila, the third in a trilogy that she's written. And it's sort of a big deal for Marilyn Robinson to write a novel. She's not very prolific, has gotten more so in recent years, but it's really great to have her come out of the woodwork and have this conversation with Bill Moyers, and it's a wonderful conversation. It just really feels like she's dispensing wisdom. You know, she's just sort of strewing wisdom, truth, and beauty before the viewer. So I really recommend Bill Moyers' interview with Marilyn Robinson on the PBS website.
Fantastic. Julia Turner, what do you have?
So we talked on our show last week about Serial, which is the awesome new podcast from the This American Life crew. Oh, this is a good test. Okay. So are you clapping because you've heard it? Instead, just clap if you've listened to Serial.
Okay. Clap if you think he's innocent. Okay? Clap if you think he's guilty.
Ooh. Nail biter. All right. So, but there is another great new serialized podcast product out there, which is Startup. How many of you guys have listened to that? Okay. Uh-oh. In the war of podcast giants, I think Serial is winning by a hair. But Startup is the new podcast from Alex Blumberg, who's one of the founders of Planet Money and did some of my favorite pieces on This American Life. He's a great audio investigative journalist. His explanations of patent trolls and of the financial crisis. He's done a couple of really interesting long-form series for This American Life. Anyway, he's got a new podcast that's all about his new business, which is an attempt to start a podcast empire, essentially. And he features his conversations with his wife, his 3 a.m. anxieties about what it means to start a business, his attempt to recruit a partner, their awkward negotiation over how much of a stake that partner should have as an owner. And that partner is... a great character in the show. He's very reasonable. He's very smart. He comes up with business plans. He helps rein in the kind of zany creative force that is Alex Blumberg, which we learn a little bit more about than we've gotten in previous doses if you're a fan of his work. And do you know who he is? Matt Lieber, our first producer, one of our first producers, the man who reined us in. Yeah, when we were all knock-kneed and we didn't know each other, and he would like tell us to act like we knew each other. And then eventually we got to know each other and it all worked out. But anyway, Startup has gotten a little bit less hubbub, but it's just great. It's totally fascinating. I love hearing more about the way Alex's brain works. And in addition, it's I feel like we live in this era of the rosy profile where you go back to the heady founding days and the dirty dorm room and the garage and the whatever, but there you're getting the real deal while they're actually in the middle of it, so it doesn't have that gloss of history. So subscribe to it and start listening to it if you haven't yet.
All right. Mr. Pinsky, what do we have?
As a book of poetry, books of poetry to read to children. People often want something to read to their kids. My kids love the poems of Walter de la Mare. Walter de la Mare, he's not as well known as Edward Lear for some reason. And in a way, they're somewhat older kids. And I think a wonderful Christmas present for a family would be the poetry of Walter de la Mare.
Wonderful. All right, well, to conclude... are you a Randall Jarrell? Are you a fan of his criticism at all? Or
yes,
Poetry in the Age. It was a terrific book. Well, he also wrote a very
The Bat Poet.
What's that?
The Bat Poet.
Ah,
it's his children's poem.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that poem.
I was trying to anticipate what you were saying.
Yeah, not that one.
And failed. And failed.
Yeah, I thought you said Andy's a bad poet, and I thought you speak ill of the dead.
I think he had that slight joke in mind. The character is a bat, but he is a bat poet.
Okay. All right. So I am going to endorse. I was thinking, okay, so when I sit on a stage in Boston, Massachusetts, I think of two things preeminently. The first is the great line from Spinal Tap, "It's not a big college town." don't worry that you're not selling out the Wilbur guys, which I think we did, so it's fine. But and then the second thing I think is that it's a bunch of sort of the American Athenians or sort of Athenian Puritans, super educated, university associated geniuses, which puts me to mind to the things that rescued my sanity when I felt like the preeminent idiot of my graduate program in English at Yale, not in Boston. Which is my sanity was kept somewhat in balance by academic satires, Lucky Jim being, I think, the greatest one ever. This unsurpassably great academic satire by Kingsley Amis takes place in England in the, I believe, 50s. But however, there's one that people don't read that often, which is Groves of Academe, everyone reads also when you move on from Lucky Jim. But the other one is Randall Jarrell wrote a very peculiar book. It's not really a novel. He called it Pictures from an Institution because there's something static about it, and it's very much portraiture. And the central figure in it is Mary McCarthy as she enters. It's a Romana Clay about Mary McCarthy entering his institution, which at the time was maybe Bennington or Wellesley.
I think it was Bennington.
Yeah, Bennington. And someone has got a... It could have been. Can you give me five? I'm rapping here. No, it could have been. I think they all taught it all. It's Sarah Lawrence, but I think she may have been at Bennington with Jarrell for a while.
We're getting a lot of submissions from this crowd.
The point being, she had come to anatomize in this reptilian way academia and leave it kind of quivering and half dead. And he became fascinated with her doing this and created this astonishing portrait of her along the way to talking about what the real predicament of academia was in the United States in the 50s. I believe he wrote it in the 50s, which was that you would put all of these people into a hothouse and the university was now the patron or going to be a great patron of the arts. And he gets at the predicament of being the person who's responsible for injecting spontaneity into this airless chamber, and whether that's a privilege or a curse. It's a wonderful book. So Pictures from an Institution.
That sounds great. I'm going to read that and The Bat Poet.
Oh, my God. I feel like I need a huff on an iron lung after that. That was a hell of a wind-up. Robert Pinsky, thank you so much for joining us tonight. All right, I do believe that there's drinking going on after we stop, or Q&A and then some drinking, so stick around for that. And this brings us to the end of this, the Boston Live Culture Gabfest. Boston, thank you so much. Awesome time. Our producer is Mike Volo. Our intern is Josephine Livingston. Thanks also to Aaron Bergen, Shannon Hansen, and Lindsay Nelson, and to the staff and management of this, the beautiful Wilbur Theater in Boston. It is a great place. And especially big thanks once again to our sponsor, Acura, for bringing the GabFest to five cities nationwide this fall. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner and the wonderful Robert Pinsky, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you soon. We're going to take about four or five questions. I think there's a hot mic over there.
What about the guitar in the room?
Also,
all right. Let me examine the patient.
We'll take a question while Steve gets acquainted.
Hi. I'd just like to first for Julia. First, I'd like to say I think Brian Lauder, June Thomas, and the wonderful Simon Doonan would make a great gay GabFest for Slate.
That would be, I would listen to that for sure. Andy Bowers is the man to talk to. He's nodding in the wings.
The question I have for you is, I'd like you to talk about Ebola, just generally. Okay. But talk about Ebola in terms of, you know, how pop culture, internet culture, the media have kind of fed into the whole hysteria about Ebola in the United States.
Yes, I can talk about that. I mean, it's a really interesting position to be in journalistically, right? Because there's a set of, the reasonable thing to do is to not freak out, right? Like, it is not as contagious as we've been led to believe that it is from countless movies with Rene Russo in a hazmat suit. But on the other hand, it's very scary. It's very unfamiliar. It now seems like the early cases in the United States have been mishandled in ways that do raise concerns beyond what we were initially told. And so there's a role for journalists in dispensing public health information and saying, don't freak out, and here's how it's actually transmitted, and in fact, hysteria is not useful. But when then the public health apparatus falls down on the job, there's also a role for journalism pointing out those lapses and mistakes and finding the right balance between you know, covering whether the response has been reasonable and appropriate, and freaking people out all the time is a difficult one to strike. We're lucky at Slate to have just a great science editor who's been a constant voice of reasonableness in her assigning on this. So that's been terrific. Just as a citizen and like person who takes airplanes and, you know, like uses public restrooms and whatever, it is interesting, I think, in a case like this to square what the culture has taught you about epidemics and pandemics with the news events. I mean, if you watch movies, like if you watch Outbreak or you watch The Hot Zone or, you know, I guess Contagion, the recent Soderbergh movie had a slightly different ending. Even the whole Planet of the Apes franchise that's happening right now posits like a pandemic that's wiped out the globe. Walking Dead, the most popular show in the history of the universe. Also, it's, you know, all zombie movies are basically Contagion movies, right? And they never end the way this one will likely end, which is with lots and lots of very sad deaths, but probably not the end of life on Earth as we know it. And so when you see the beginning of a story that in the movie always ends with the end of life on Earth as we know it, it's a little hard to know how to respond emotionally to a news story that you don't see play out in a more realistic way on film. I don't know, Dana, if you've had thoughts about this.
I mean, we actually, believe it or not, talking about Ebola and the kind of cultural reaction there too for this show. We were trying to just talk about, you know, come up with topic ideas and say, well, what's hot right now? What do people care about? What are people talking
it's
about?
It's not hot.
Well, it's in the sense of like holding a hot pan and dropping it, right? Like, what is making people like jump back in fear?
Good save.
Right? And in the end, we couldn't because of precisely because of the danger that somebody would come out and say something like that. It was too hot of a topic to talk about in a live show. Essentially, it didn't work.
Well, and I'm still waiting for someone to write the great essay about how these cultural presentations of it shape the way you perceive the actual version of it, I think. I mean, I think there is probably some interesting essay to be mined there, but we haven't read it.
I mean, honestly, me, from a personal point of view, when I see, you know, Americans with our affluent society and our great medical system getting all het up about the fact that two people have died in the country of Ebola, and I think about the damage that it's wreaked already in Africa, and that suddenly we're all talking about it now because of that, I don't know, this all seems a little unseemly to me.
And the number of... And here's a little PSA, the number of people who will die because they didn't get a flu shot. Like, get a flu shot. Come on.
Yeah, get a flu shot.
Lots of different ways to live. Choose life.
Steve now has, just narrating for our listeners at home, the guitar is blue. It's lovely. It's sitting on Steve's lap, and there is strumming happening.
If you think I'm going to sing something, you are fucked in the head.
You promised. All right, another question.
All right.
All right. We'll take one. We'll take another question and let him absorb those boos, and then his ego can fight his pride. And next
okay,
question.
Great. I have a question for Dana Stevens, which is: if you were an all-powerful producer and you were charged with making the great Moby Dick Hollywood adaptation, who would you have direct it, and who would you cast?
Oh, wow. I need an hour with a pen and paper to come up with an answer to that. I mean, that's sort of a famously unfilmable, right? That's if you can think of one unfilmable American novel, it has to be Moby Dick.
Think of the Ambergris montage.
Okay, would you rather have Paul Thomas Anderson or Wes Anderson direct the movie?
You know, actually, Paul Thomas Anderson would certainly be interested in the themes and the questions of Moby Dick. I don't know. I think to really, really do it, you would have to make it almost a miniseries or a 12-hour-long movie. You know, to get any kind of sense of how many mountains have to be scaled, you know, in order to get through that story, you would need, I don't know, somebody who's not alive anymore, like Abel Gance, you know, the filmmaker who made that three-part, three-screen, 12-hour Napoleon movie, or something gargantuan. I don't know. I don't have an answer, but you'd have to have somebody write it. Like, who's even alive that could write that screenplay? I don't know. Maybe you'd have to travel back in time and get Dalton Trumbo to write the screenplay and Abel Gance to direct it. I don't know. People who aren't here anymore. I wouldn't take on such a project.
I'm digging the Dalton Trumbo name check. So awesome. He was one of the Hollywood Eight or whatever the number
he
was.
He was one of the blacklisted screenwriters. Yeah, he's just sort of one of the great legendary screenwriters. I mean, to film great literature, you have to have a great artist. And I don't know if there's any filmic artist I can think of right now who could grapple with that.
That's so depressing. That can't be true. I don't know. I would watch. I like your miniseries idea. Let's just get this going. Let's do Paul Thomas Anderson, 8 episodes. Let's be reasonable, Dana. I think we'll just throw Michael Keaton in as Ahab. And no, he wouldn't be a good Ahab. Anyway, all right. All right, Steve, you ready, or do we need to do one more?
It's like this is a trust fall off of the fucking Empire State.
You promised.
Can we do one more question? I see an eager face at the mic. We've only had two.
You got to see me make guitar face. What do you want?
So I'm going to start out by doing something I don't do at work and kiss your ass a little bit. Your podcast has been a constant companion for me for many, many years, first on with my iPod and now with my iPhone. Steven, you have sent me running to the dictionary so many times. Whereas I'm like, who really talks like that? So my question is, you know, you've discussed cultural issues both high and low. What's your guilty pleasure?
You talking to me?
I'm talking to all three of you.
Oh, okay.
Or four, if we want to count Professor Pinsky.
I don't think there are guilty pleasures anymore because we've all embraced our low culture selves. And we all shouted from the rooftops, don't we?
I mean, I feel like we're always embracing guilty pleasures on the show. That's a lot of what endorsement seems like it's about. They happen to be kind of highbrow today, but most of the time I feel like we're right down there, you know, wallowing in the pop culture mud.
I mean, I think, you know, when we had that conversation with Carl Wilson at our Montreal show, and he, in his great book, which we'll just all endorse again, Let's Talk About Love by Carl Wilson, which is an examination of taste in the form of a very close reading of a Celine Dion album, you know, but he talks, but that's basically what that book is about, is sort of the end of shame and the kind of like schmaltzy middle brow that's the last thing that it's not cool to like. But now it's cool to like Carl's book about Celine Dion. So, and to even like Celine Dion, I don't know. I don't think there are guilty pleasures anymore for me. Steve, what are you? You must have shame, Steve.
Okay, so I went on. I went on Hang Up and Listen, the sports podcast.
I heard that.
You heard that.
That was awesome.
And they asked, you know, it used to be, well, anyway, I won't frame it quite that way. They asked me to talk about the Jets and New York Jets. And I think they sat back in horror at what they had unleashed. And I think right around when I was saying that the number four wide receiver on the Jets ran a crisp, he ran a crisp pattern and had plus hands, Josh Levine, in that dry Josh Levine way, says, "So, Steve, is this what you're thinking about when Dana and Julia are talking?" I was like, "Oh yeah, nailed it." No, I'm a Jet. Like, I'm just so bizarrely obsessed with the Jets, and I'm at that moment where you have to give up the sport in good conscience. I mean, it's just too. You can't watch it anymore. You can't.
But you're not going to, are you?
I am trying not to. Did you see my tooth, by the way? Have I told you about? Did you listen to the LA show? Maybe not. I lost a tooth, and it hasn't been replaced yet. And when I laugh really hard, which is almost never a danger with these two. No, kidding. No, you can see this like huge. It sends this kind of cold electric shiver up people's spines when I'm in the middle of charming them. So, anyway, what were we talking about?
I think you were saying that football is your guilty pleasure.
No, I think you can't. I try not to give it any money. Like, I try not to let it monetize my fascination with it.
I don't know what that means if you're like streaming Bulgarian broadcasts or something. But okay. All right. Any more questions there?
So in your discussion of Birdman, you talked about one particularly nasty stereotype of a critic as sort of a crabby hater. And I recently heard a totally different sort of dig at cultural critics from perhaps a surprising source. John and Craig from the Script Notes podcast were on your last live show, and then I listened to their podcast following their appearance on your show. And I was a little surprised to hear them put in some harsh digs against culture critics as being overly intellectual elitists operating in an echo chamber talking to one another. And I wondered, first, if you had heard that and were surprised, and also what you might say in response.
I haven't listened to that show yet, although I did see that they had a little after segment where they discussed the segment we had together. We have not recorded an after segment yet, but perhaps we should listen to theirs and then record our own. I can't really respond without having heard what they said. I think those guys are really smart when they talk about the craft of screenwriting. I didn't mean that as so I'm just going to leave it there because apparently that was a sick burn.
I mean, I would only add that I expected that on stage from them, because that kind of enmity between critics and creators of culture, it's a very deep thing that goes way back. At the New York Film Critics Circle awards dinner that happens every year, every speech is some sort of, you know, snarky roast by the person getting an award to the people giving them an award, you know. And so there's this weird back and forth. It's all part of the, you know, cultural machine, so it doesn't bother me at all.
Okay, my question is for Robert Pinsky. You wrote the libretto for Todd Machover's opera Death and the Powers, which was here in Boston 4 or so years ago, created in collaboration with the MIT Media Lab. And as we delve further into the 21st century, I'm curious, and technology is taking over all of our lives and the arts, I'm curious how much of the technology played a part in your creation of the libretto.
The libretto is about robots.
Right. The opera is about
robots. It's a robot opera. And the central character is a super kajillionaire. He's a kind of a combination of Walt Disney and, I guess, Bill Gates or somebody. And he has his consciousness downloaded so that he can go out of his physical body, but his consciousness is still there. And he wants his family to follow him. He has a daughter with a social conscience, doesn't want that to happen. And there are robots. The robots are a big feature of the opera. So to say I wasn't influenced by technology would be strange. I do notice that the headlines seem that there are more and more feature stories that seem to be about our opera. I must say the opera, it premiered in Monaco, then it was done across the street here at the Majestic, and it recently was done in Dallas, and I had seen those other performances, and this is about technology, I guess. I watched it on a podcast at MIT. Not podcast, what do I mean? Simulcast. The old Robert's birthday.
We're just going to edit that right out in the podcast.
The simulcast.
Because it's a podcast, you just said simulcast.
The simulcast, I had a director, it was interesting, the film thing, I had a director telling me where to look. I wasn't always looking at the same robot or the same singer. And it was a much more satisfying aesthetic experience for me to see Death and the Powers in that simulcast. It was better for me cinematically than in the theater. That may just be autobiography, but it may be something about the tech. There's a lot of technology in there. Three huge, I forget what they're called, tall triangles that rotate, and they function as screens. So there's a lot of images, and these robots are moving around, then there are the singers. And I found the technology of the opera was more effective and more dramatic when I watched it on a screen with a director helping me watch it. And I wrote the thing.
All right. I think that's enough questions, right?
But are we good?
Steve, you have to sing something. You have to. It can be like a verse, but your voice must alight.
Right, Dana,
I think you promised
singing
One by Bono on One Knee in Bono voice, but you can pick something else.
I see the look of incipient horror on your face.
It's not. I'm so excited.
Otherwise known as incipient. I don't know why. I love it. Incipient just sounds right to me. Oh, do you feel the same? I can't. I mean, how can I possibly? I have a great story about why I gave up doing this.
No, just one line. One line. Bono voice. So far, Bono voice.
Wait, let's see. What's that? Oh, I know one because I can speak it. Dressed up like a car crash. Wheels are spinning, but you're upside down.
You're a brave man.
What's that?
I said you're a brave man.
I'm going to go take so many drugs. All right, that's the Culture Gap Fest. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming out.